We learn music like we learn language. We listen, we speak, we think, we improvise, and the last thing we do is learn to read and write. And you mentioned reading. We don't read the patterns until they are sufficiently able to recognize them, enchant them, and use them, and understand the categories.
Well, good day, everyone. It's Tim Topham here again for episode number 48 of the Tim Topham TV Piano Teaching Podcast. It's fantastic to have you with me. Thank you so much for being a listener or a viewer, wherever you are in the world and whatever you're doing at the moment. I really appreciate it. As you know, my goal with these podcasts is to help introduce you to new ideas, to let you meet these fantastic people from all around the world that are doing great things for piano teaching, to inspire you, to perhaps challenge you. And this month is absolutely no exception. In fact, I think, as I mentioned in my first blog post of the month, that this month's focus on music learning theory could be one of the most important months of all for you to listen and engage with the podcast and blogs at timtopham.com, because music learning theory is one of those things that is so groundbreaking, that is so universal, and that is so important for our students right from the beginning piano teaching lessons, that I think it can have an amazing impact on everything that's going on around the world. I really do believe that music learning theory, the approach of Dr. Gordon and the people that have followed him, have really made an outstanding contribution to music education, and I can only hope that the ideas spread. So today's guest is Marilyn Monroe. Not Munro, Marilyn Lowe, sorry, is the author, in cooperation with Dr. Edwin Gordon, of the audiation-based method Music Moves for Piano. She holds degrees from Knox College and Indiana University. She studied piano under Manahan Pressler and continues to study the music theory doctoral program. She served in a variety of capacities in church music and continues to teach piano and present workshops today. In fact, when we were recording this, she was just about to fly all over the place to present her next series of workshops on the music learning theory method, and in particular, how people can practically use her books, which are called Music Moves for Piano. And we're going to find out more about that. It's actually the only piano method written down approach that uses the music learning theory concept. So you're going to be find this really, really fascinating, because it puts a lot of things into perspective and practice. Today's show notes are at timtopham.com/episode48. And I've got an amazing download for you today. Marilyn has been incredibly generous in letting me copy a number of pages from her book, Music Moves for Piano, the teacher guide for this, to give you some really great starting ideas for this approach and the thinking behind it and the teaching that goes on behind it. So it's actually going to be a package. It's going to be a number of pages long. So it's going to include some pages from her fantastic resource, her books there. It's going to include an introduction to audiation from some workshops she has been giving this year. It's going to include Dr. Edwin Gordon's Language versus Music Literacy, a one-page sheet there, which compares the two approaches and the similarities about them, and why linking music acquisition and language acquisition and music acquisition makes so much sense. There is also a sheet of all the notations, duple meter, triple meter patterns, and the approaches that are used there. And I'm also going to throw in a glossary of the Music Moves for Piano and the Music Learning Theory words that are going to be used a lot in this month. So you can check through and understand exactly what we're talking about when we come to things like audiation. As usual, if you could spare a quick chance to jump over on iTunes and leave a review, I'd be really appreciative. You just need to head to timtopham.com/iTunes to find the instructions. And if you can subscribe on iTunes, that would be great too. If you're finding the time to sit in front of your computer and listen to podcasts is really difficult, I do. In fact, it's not the way that I absorb podcasts, and I listen to a lot of podcasts. I generally always do it in the car or while I'm cooking with headphones in. Whatever it is, I'd really recommend that if you haven't already done it, try using your app to listen to these podcasts, because it's a really great thing to do while you're cleaning the house or cycling or walking, whatever it is. I think that's the best way to absorb it. The way you do that is just find the podcast app on whatever device you're on, Apple, Android, Samsung, doesn't really matter. Find the podcast app or download one. There's a great one called Overcast, and just search for Tim Topham. You'll find my podcast on there, and you can become a subscriber. That means that every new episode automatically downloads to your device, and you can just listen to it wherever you are, whether you're 30,000 feet in the air or you're swimming in the pool. All right, let's get started with the interview today. I know you're going to really, really enjoy it. This is my interview with Marilyn Rowe. Sorry, I don't know why I keep calling her Marilyn Rowe. Marilyn Lowe, all about music moves for piano and music learning theory. Well, Marilyn, welcome to Tim Topham TV. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, we've been in touch for probably at least a year when I first found out about your Music Moves for Piano books. And I actually went to the National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy in Chicago last year. And that was when Dr. Gordon was going to be doing his speech, which didn't actually happen, but we were all able to hear it and then find a recording, find a written version of it. And I just loved everything that I read in it, and it just connected completely with me. So I had to then dive deeper, and I found out about you and your books as well. So some of our viewers might be familiar with Music Moves for Piano, your method based on this music learning theory concept, but perhaps Can we find out a little bit more about you as a teacher? What kind of things are you doing at the moment? Are you still teaching, or are you working more as a sort of presenter and a workshop person? What do you do day to day now?
I love teaching. I will always teach. I have a small studio of 15, 16 students, but I continue to learn, and this approach just amazes me. All my life I've taught, and this is what I love doing.
Great. So this month on the blog is all about music learning theory. So let's get right to the core of it. Can you tell us, what is music learning theory all about?
Music learning theory is about how we learn when we learn music. It's not a method. It's not an approach. It's researched based. It's about the learning process.
Okay. And it's about the, and who's can you tell us a bit about Dr. Gordon? Because you've obviously met him. I've only kind of read about him and seen videos about him. Sounds like a pretty interesting guy.
Oh, and an amazing person. Just thoroughly focused on, as he said, I know one thing, and that's about audiation. He has a music degree from Eastman. He has a PhD in psychology, and was familiar with works of like Vygotsky, et cetera. And he toured when he was younger as a string bass player with Gene Krupa. He had perfect tempo and rhythm. And he, in his research, has benefited from all the amazing music educators of the past, Dalcro, Suzuki, Kodai, Orff, and his development of music learning theory with his creation of a music vocabulary, I think, is what makes everything else work. It's very special.
Yeah. So you've said it's not a method or an approach. It's a theory of how we learn. Is that right?
Yes, it's a learning process.
Process. Okay. And so you've taken the learning process and your understanding of that and created Music Moves for Piano. Would you call that a method? Or is that an...
That's an application of the learning process that Gordon researched to piano instruction.
Okay, so tell us about this process that Dr. Gordon researched and spent so much time getting right. Well, what is it about, and why is it so different to what most teachers do?
Okay, he had two basic principles. One is that sound comes before sight, and the other is that practice comes before theory.
Okay.
In doing this, he has developed a sequenced approach, a sequenced way of teaching a music vocabulary. and ways of teaching a tonal vocabulary and a rhythm vocabulary that are categorized, functional, sequenced, and within a context. Context is the missing link.
Okay.
We don't teach in context.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about that, because I think most of us can agree that it's great for students to understand, let's say, for example, rhythmic patterns and be able to not have to think about them, just to be able to look at them and go, oh, yeah, that's, you know, a tango pattern or whatever it is. What is it about the context that's missing in most of our instruction if we haven't had this approach?
Well, duple meter versus triple meter. We have to understand one to know the other, just like we don't know what black is unless we see what white is. So students from the very beginning learn what duple meter patterns are and then what triple meter patterns are and the difference. Tonality, major, minor, and then, of course, there are all the other tonalities and the other meters, but we start with those two basic tonalities and meters.
Yeah. So from the beginning, students are being drilled in movement and vocalization of rhythmic patterns in duple and triple meter, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then they're seeing that, or I guess I'm asking a question, are they then sort of seeing those patterns and singing those patterns in songs and in the music that they're playing?
Yes. Absolutely. They hear them. They write them. The patterns are very special. They are categorized. And students learn them in four, we call them macro beats, four beat phrases. So this builds the ability to hear music and recognize one phrase and then another phrase, etc. And they use this phrase structure when they compose and improvise.
It does. And you've mentioned composing and improvising. It sounds like the approach is very holistic in regard to, once you learn a pattern, let's not just learn to read it, let's improvise a tapping pattern on that, or let's go and improvise it on the piano somehow. Is that also a part of the approach?
Everything a student learns is used in improvisation, just like language. When we learn words, it's very language. We learn music like we learn language. We listen, we speak, we think, we improvise, and the last thing we do is learn to read and write. And you mentioned reading. We don't read the patterns until they are sufficiently able to recognize them and chant them and use them and understand the categories. The brain likes categories. And everything is categorized. Everything is functional. Rhythm patterns are anrhythmic, which is a concept that is often not a common concept, I guess. When you chant ba ba ba, for example, and say notate it, well, 2/8 quarter, 2/4 half, 2/2 whole, all of those different ways of notating the rhythm will sound the same.
Did you say anrhythmic?
Rhythmic.
Okay, meaning that those patterns can look different on the page even though they feel and sound the same. Is that right?
That's it, exactly.
Yeah. Which can be incredibly confusing, of course, can't it?
It is confusing if children are taught too soon from notation.
Yeah.
To count. Half note gets 2 beats, etc. Quarter note gets 1 beat. That is not correct, period.
Yeah.
And it does not prepare them for later on when they're able to think abstractly and they can write. I had one student playing the Avalanche, which is 1/4 3/8, and he said, oh, I could write that in 6/8.
Ah, yeah. That's the kind of connections you want them to make, isn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned language before. I think in my reading of Dr. Gordon's research, it's the similarities with language acquisition that was most striking to me, that reading, we don't learn to read until we're, I don't know, how old are we, 4 or 5 or something?
Or older.
Yeah.
There was a study done in Germany that verified that children did not need to learn to read until they were 9.
Right.
Now, we take that to the extreme here. But I do believe sometimes we stress reading too soon. I'd rather have them tell stories, learn vocabulary, listen to stories, as far as even language is concerned. But yeah. Definitely music.
Yeah.
It takes
And if you see children learn to speak, they will start with da and ba 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 and things like that, won't they? These babble. And that's mm-hmm. that's somewhat of this approach too, isn't it? That you start with we don't babble, but in some ways you do, because a lot of the pattern and the chanting and things is not with words, it's just with neutral syllables, right?
Yep, correct.
Yep.
But they have meaning.
Mm. Can you give us an example of a pattern that they might learn and how they would learn to chant or recite it and that sort of thing?
Well, let's take a triple meter pattern because triple meter is not as commonly used. I could say ba 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 ba. Translated into syllables, that would be do-da-dee-do, do-da-dee-do. That's a simple macromacari pattern.
Mm-hmm.
When we get division patterns, I'll chant syllables, do-ta-da-ta-dee-ta-do, do-ta-da-ta-dee-ta-do. And then we have elongations and divisions, do-ta-ta-ta-do, do-ta-ta-ta-do. And rest patterns, do to do to dot to d to do, tie patterns, do to dot to d, and upbeat patterns, to d to do, da dee do, et cetera.
Okay.
So those categories.
Yeah, yeah. And students will be chanting these back as a reply to you?
Yes.
Yeah. As one way of learning them?
Right. And the principle is if they can chant the pattern accurately with me as the teacher alone, then I ask them to chant it by themselves. And if they can chant it by themselves accurately, they have ownership of the pattern.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you can then take it to, okay, let's improvise or let's explore it some more.
Right.
Yeah. And so why is learning those patterns so fundamental, in your opinion, for effective music learning?
Oh, they're the music vocabulary, just like a word vocabulary. That's all I can say. Students will come and they'll have a piece and playing it says, oh, that sounds just like old woman. Bum, bum, bum might be the pattern. They're associating, they're listening, they're recognizing these patterns and sounds in other music. It's the patterns. When we learn note by note by note, we have nothing to associate with other music that we hear.
Mm. Yeah, and it's so crucial because making those connections really builds your knowledge and your sort of your foundation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what are the main benefits that you see for students of this approach to learning?
They are comfortable performing because they've learned how to improvise. They mm-hmm. can always feel they can work themselves out of any situation. They love to improvise, and that is something that one of the reasons I actually started searching for something else, because my students would freeze when I take away the music, and I'd say, no, just make up something. And they couldn't. They just were frozen. So they're comfortable improvising. I could schedule a recital tomorrow and say, we're just going to improvise, and every student could improvise a piece. Mm-hmm. And some of them will be improvising duets. They can improvise. They can arrange music. They can play by ear. They can make variations, medleys. Some of the older students make quite a bit of money playing for parties and
that's great.
Kinds of events.
Yeah, well, it sounds really holistic in the outcome. And I would imagine most teachers watching would be going, oh, yeah, this sounds fantastic. So we'll dig into a little bit more in a moment. But you just mentioned that you didn't always, well, I gathered you didn't always teach this approach. When did you start and why?
Well, I have taught probably every piano method in the market and wonder why my students still played without flow. Flow is a word I use all the time now with my students. As soon as they learn something, I would say, now flow, and then the music happens. I just was not happy. They couldn't improvise. They had trouble arranging, playing by ear. And I started searching, as I always do, works of researchers and people that write about music. And I discovered Gordon, went to a workshop. And I felt immediately like concrete blocks were lifted from my shoulder. It explained rhythm to me. It was just exactly what I wanted.
Mm.
So I asked him.
Go on.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, I asked him, I said, I need a piano method. Where can I get one? He said, well, there isn't one. You'll need to write it. So he started emailing back and forth. What can I put on a page when you're teaching orally? It just turns things totally upside down because you have to have the right kind of music to teach orally. You have to have the patterns. You have to put some things on the page so students know what fingers, hands, etc., keys to use. So it was, it's been an interesting process.
How long did all that take from this, when you first learned about it to when you first had your book ready?
Okay, started it in 1992. The first book was actually in print in 2004. And I finally finished this whole series just 2-3 years ago.
Right. I've seen your books and I've started exploring them, and I, you know, it is unfathomable to me how long it must have taken you, not only just to come up with the concepts and the approach, but to detail it so clearly for teachers. It's an amazing amount of work you've done there. It's fantastic. And I must say it's really helps. Has helped me understand more about how the process works, for sure. And I think it's also great because you've got, I'm wondering if I've got it. Oh, I've somewhere here. You've also got the patterns on CD, which listening to those made things much clearer, because you mentioned things like the method, you know, use neutral syllables, but to actually listen to how that sounds with someone doing it on the recording was great. And of course, students can use that recording too, so they can practice at home. I think, yeah, it's great. I really love that it's just such a different approach, but makes so much sense, so much sense.
All the patterns are also in print. And as students get older, just depending, every child is different. Every student is different. And I love this approach because you can individualize instruction while I have 3 or 4 students here. But some 7, 8, 9-year-olds then can read from the book of tonal patterns and rhythm patterns, chant the patterns or sing the tonal patterns, and have the other students then respond.
Mm.
So, you see, they're really proud when they get to that point.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And I like this relationship between learning to read note by note, which is similar to learning to read words by just learning the letters. Like if you only ever learn to read the letters, right, you'll never be able to read, right? So learning patterns is like learning the words. So instead of students having to say "cat" for a cat, mm-hmm, they're just seeing a cat, right?
Yeah.
So does this approach work for all ages, or is it mainly for younger beginners? So now we're talking, I guess, about your particular method books, the Music Moves for Piano books.
It works for all ages. It depends on the desire and the patience. Several of us have taught older students. Some have had 12 years of piano. And it's just interesting watching them flounder when there's not the music up in front of them. Then they have to play it by ear, and then they have to remember a pattern and improvise with it, and they can do it. It depends on, like I say, their desire to be able to learn this way.
Mm.
And transfer students also gradually work into it very nicely. It just takes time and patience.
Yeah, I certainly see that it's not a quick method. My understanding is that it would move, just by looking at the books, it would move slower, but it would be far more comprehensive.
Right. It's not quick in terms of thinking when are they going to be reading music independently, that area. But students in the process of learning these patterns and improvising learned by rote many difficult pieces. I've had 7, 8, 9 year olds play pieces like Puck, Griggs Puck, and some Musinski pieces, and very complicated pieces that they could never read, but they can, they learn how to play during this process. And they learn how to learn.
So do you, for your method, do you need to be trained to use that method, or can any teacher pick up the books and give it a shot?
Well, this depends on the teacher. Training certainly helps. There are workshops sponsored by the Gordon Institute of Music Learning. I'm teaching a 2-week workshop in Boston later on this summer. Teachers give workshops, day workshops, and go to conferences. Mentors. This is an excellent way to learn, to have someone in your community who's using the approach and them help you. So it...
So, yes, it helps, but you could, using the resources you've got and watching recordings of YouTubes or something, you know, something like that. I think, you could do it. It seems to make sense that you really need to go and watch someone present it.
Give it a try, Tim, on your own teaching. Let me know how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I've started exploring it, and as I say, I love the concept behind the approach. I found that it's almost overwhelming. There's so much information there. It's hard to know how to do it, particularly when you're taking on, you're trying the concepts with a student who is already having lessons, or you've taken on as a transfer student. I think that's a little bit trickier. But I've got more work to do on it, that's for sure. That's why I wanted to speak to you about it.
You have to be selective in what you're doing. For instance, start with rhythm, chanting, patterns, and improvising with those patterns, mentioning the categories, teaching the contrast between duple and triple. You know, take a couple of years with some of these transfer students. It's amazing where they end up. I've had that experience. But it does take patience. But just take an activity. Look at the improvisation activities. Learn a song to sing and the patterns from it, and relate those patterns to a piece of students' learning.
The rhythmic things were the most relevant to me, I think, because I know how hard that is. Everyone struggles with rhythm, and we shouldn't. We only struggle with rhythm because we haven't learnt the patterns. So that's where I can see it being really handy to for me to explore anyway, and for other teachers who might be listening and who might be interested.
Right. And this is based on body movement. So on the website, Music Moves for Piano, there's a demonstration of body movement where students put the tempo beat in their heels. They're standing like that. And then padding, splitting that tempo beat into either 2 for duple or 3 for triple. And once they get coordinate with that, they can chant rhythm patterns.
Yeah.
So fun, just away from the keyboard activity.
And I think the whole body movement approach is great. And, there's elements of kind of Del Crow's in there. There's elements of Orff in there for the rhythm too. And I've got podcasts on both of those two approaches. So it's great to be able to kind of combine them and start getting them in my mind, the connections between them. What do you feel is the biggest downfall of most beginner methods, the most popular methods out there?
Start with reading notation.
And why is that always such a problem?
Because that's not the way we think music. When we should hear in phrases, we should hear, actually, as someone said, we should hear what we see on the page. And until we're teaching it backwards, when we're saying, look, this is what it is, it's theoretical, it's something unfamiliar. So they really need to be familiar with what they see on the page, like reading words. It's very difficult to read a sentence if you don't know the meaning of any of the words. So unless they know the meaning of the patterns and the sense of tonality, major, minor, the meter, the reading doesn't make musical sense.
Yeah, which is why it's so slow and such a struggle.
Yes.
Yeah. And you've mentioned now a couple of times audiation, or this concept of hearing before you look, I guess. And this is, I think, is this a term that Dr. Gordon coined himself?
Yes, it is. He worked on it for several years with several people and finally came up with that term.
So audiation, to me, before I started finding out about music learning theory, was just being able to hear something. So if you saw music, you'd be able to kind of hear what it would sound like in your head. But I don't think that's quite his approach. How do you see audiation? Because this is quite core to this concept.
Yeah, he has a whole book on audiation. There are different types and different stages of audiation. There's a lot of ways to audiate. You can audiate. Well, here's a good example. You have a score in front of you of a popular tune. And so you don't play all the notes, but you play it very satisfactorily by understanding the rhythm and the pitch and the changes, etc. And that is an example of audiation from notation. I don't know if I explained that well.
Can you give us another example of audiation? Because I can understand that example where if you are skilled enough, you can look at music and you can get a feeling for it in your head before you hear it. How does audiation work in the actual approach that you take with your students?
Well, I tell students first that it's in the mind. We visualize. I have them close their eyes and visualize scenes. I have them close their eyes and think thoughts. And then I have them close their eyes and hear music in their head. Mm-hmm. And that is audiation, is hearing and comprehending music in the mind without it needing to be present. And like I said, there are 6 stages of audiation and 8 types of audiation. So it is very detailed how it works. This is what Gordon's all about, is audiation.
Okay. And the importance of that as a performer and a student. Why? I guess that's my question. Why is it so important to be able to audiate, to be able to hear in your head?
Well, it's important in listening to music. We hear with understanding, and I still am amazed at what I hear when I go to a concert. It's totally different from when I was in graduate school. I hear a symphony like I'm reading a book. I know I can anticipate and predict. I can remember what happened before. I can compare what happened in an exposition with what's happening in the development or the recap. It's much, much more interesting to understand music. The same is true in performance. We know where we are. We know what to expect. We know how to get in and out of places because we are audiating. Students continue to come. This always amazes me. They'll come with, "That sounds like." It might be even just one little kindergartner was playing ba 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 one piano key, and he looked up and said, "That sounds like Jingle Bells." Making these connections.
No, that's great. So your Music Moves for Piano books, are they the only ones that put music learning theory into a practical method that you know of?
Yes, that apply Gordon's music learning theory, yes.
Yeah, it's great. And you have teachers using this all around the world, I would assume. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I know you've got a Facebook group too, haven't you, for users of your method?
Yes.
Which is great. So we'll pop a link to that on can anyone join that, or do they have to have your books already?
Basically, the teachers group is for teachers. There is a Facebook page that is for everyone, and that is really very popular, and it has a lot of video clips. It of demonstrations, and that is the first page to go to on Facebook. There are many YouTubes. If you Google Gordon or Google MLT, there are quite a few YouTube videos.
There's videos of him as well, isn't there, in action, yes. Teaching. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so what would a typical Music Moves for Piano lesson look like in, say, the first few months of lessons with a beginner? What are some of the kind of key features that you would use and go through?
Okay, well, we would start standing, and I have them, and this is another thing, is I've always taught at least two students together. I just have felt that a 30-minute lesson, I'd rather have two students here for an hour than one student for 30 minutes. That's just been the way I prefer teaching. So it was easy for me to have two or three or four students together. And so we'll make a group, and then we'll start with chanting rhythm patterns and sing songs and sing a lot of singing and body movement. Body movement is so important. We use, first of all, they learn body parts, shoulders and elbows and hips and so forth. And second of all, we use the Laban dance effort movements, especially weight and flow. And lots of, while I'm singing my song, would you flow like you're in space? Mm-hmm. Or would you move like you're in concrete? Or just to get the different body feels. What amazed me when I first came back from my first summer with Gordon in 1992 was I took my high school students. I didn't know what to do with the little ones, except I took away their reading books.
Yeah.
But older students I took to a music stand and said, let's move and chant while you're playing this, while we're looking at this music. They'd go back to the piano and play totally differently. They had a flow, they had a sense of what was going on that just amazed me.
Just from music, moving their bodies to the music.
Moving and sort of singing, bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, that kind of movement.
Yeah, right. It's interesting, the connection between body movement and understanding of music, isn't it? Which I think is why ORF is fantastic too.
Yeah.
You mentioned Laban or something, a dance something. What was that?
Laban was a movement, a dance movement educator. And
how do I spell that?
L-E-A-N.
Okay. I think I've heard of it, but you'll have to tell me more about that.
Well, all I know is there's an institute in London, the Laban Institute. I think he was from, I hate to say where because I might have it wrong, but not originally from England. But dancers use Laban movements, and a musical theater students will use the movements. Time, space, weight, and flow are the four movements.
Okay.
And for musicianship, to make music, musical, weight and flow are imperative. It makes a huge difference. I did a workshop once using examples from advanced piano repertoire and showed the difference between even one piece where one part would feel weight and then it would lighten up and you'd start feeling flow and you get to another part and you feel bound and then there's a continuum, so you have all degrees. You know, if you're bound, you can be extremely bound, but then it can move to being less bound.
Right.
So it's really it's an amazing way to apply to music performance of advanced repertoire.
Yeah, you've mentioned flow a few times. Flow can mean, in my mind, you know, getting into the zone. There's that aspect of flow. But I think you're talking about flow, a sense of musical flow and direction. Is that right?
I am. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that's another thing that comes from the kind of the body, moving the body in that way. Would that be right?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
I am working pretty intensely on reading now that my students are 10, 11, and 12. And we're doing sight reading, just going through books all the time. And the first playthrough is often mechanical. And then I have them play it two times. I said, now play it with flow. And they can immediately make it sound musical.
Mm.
So that, you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's get practical, I guess. For, let's say there's a teacher listening. Hopefully there's lots of teachers listening who like the sound of what you're doing. And they've got a student who's maybe been learning for a few years and they're reading a piece of music. Is there some aspects of this approach that they could try out with that student, you know, taking out a rhythm and doing something with it that would give them some, a little bit of a taster of what this method's about?
Oh, I think, again, looking for same, different. In any piece, I have students look the music over at least a week, sometimes 2 or 3 weeks before they ever take it to the keyboard, and find rhythm patterns that are the same. Just the Bach minuet, bop, 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 bop. Does that happen again? Where and so forth. It sort of map how the rhythm works in the piece. Where are the cadences? Are they all tonic? What's the chord structure? When does it change? Where does it change? All these types of analysis. The young children do it by listening. And older students should also have a lot of listening activities where they can identify this. I've had students listen to symphonies and write down the patterns that they hear or make comments about changes, cadences, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think just looking over the music, getting everything you can out of it in terms of patterns, tonic patterns, what does it start on? What does it end on? This is where the solfège system, movable do with la-based minor, works. It's the only solfège system that promotes audiation. And I will not argue the point with anyone who feels differently. There are a lot of teachers who feel differently in many, many, many places. But my students that learn this will go to universities where they have different systems they use, and they're fine. I mean, I've learned many different systems, and I always revert back to this movable do with la-based minor for understanding. I can hear where the resting tone is, and I know whether it's do or whether it's la, major or minor, and then I know what to expect in chord structures and changes. So
now, just in case there's teachers listening who have no idea what we're talking about, what is movable do with a la-based minor? What does that mean?
Okay, it means that, as I tell my piano students when they start in the beginning, they learn to play a cadence when G is do. Now, one student ran to his mother and said, I now know where do is. So I said, look over here. Here's an example of when F is do. And look over here, and here's an example when C is do. So guess what? Every piano key can be a do. And you'll have the same sound, but there'll be different keys. So that is a movable do.
Okay.
Now, the la-based minor, because there is a do-based minor too, but the la-based minor gives you the sense of tonality. So if you sing do, what are you audiating in your head? You can audiate major, you can audiate the cadences, etc. If I sing that same sound and sing la, I can think minor and audiate it. Now, to continue with that, there's a different tonality on every syllable. If I sing re, re is the resting tone for Dorian tonality. So bum, 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 bum is the cadence. And Phrygian, Mixolydian, Lydian, and so forth. Each one has its own resting tone and its own primary triads. I use this in workshops all the time where I have the triads on scale degrees, and they'll start with do, re, mi, and have the triads there. And all they have to do is shift. And the triads don't change order. When re is the resting tone for minor, then mi is also minor. So the second scale degree is minor. The seventh scale degree, do, is major. Do is always major. There are three major triads. Do, mi, so, fa, la, do, so, ti, re. Now, if you're improvising and you hit on a major triad, you can decide where you want to go, what tonality, what keyality. You can switch. And the same thing, there are only three minor triads. Oh, re, fa, la, mi, so, ti, la, do, mi. Right. And then you have the one diminished triad on T.
Gotcha. So is there quite a strong link between this Kadai approach and the music learning theory? Or is that you use that in your method?
Right. Kodai does use the movable do with a la-based minor, I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you mean by connection, because I actually did some certification courses in both Kodai and ORF and Dalcroze years ago when I was doing my search.
Yeah.
And I don't know how.
Sorry, my question was, is the use of Kodai part of the music moves for piano method, or is it something that Dr. Gordon's research has connected with this whole theory of learning? Does that make sense?
I think so. I think actually Gordon's research and all these, with all these music educators, kind of melded together, and he was able to process their thoughts. They were not, they did not do research. They just came up with teaching ideas.
Mm.
It was after them that came up with a method, but those like Kodai did not develop a lot of the materials that are now used in the Kodai approach.
That's the same way the ORF. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Huh. Okay. So in answer to the question, which was about how teachers could think in a music learning theory approach with a student, you've mentioned listening. So doing a lot of listening, looking for patterns. You've mentioned a lot about chanting. So perhaps they could take, let's say the da ba 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 ba, the minuet pattern. Maybe they could take that out. They could chant it back and forth with the teacher. That they could perhaps improvise on it somehow. Am I on the right kind of track?
Oh yes. Okay. Oh, yes.
Yep. Great.
Incidentally, that's the 2-Macabeat rhythm pattern. Do da da dee da do da dee. So that's two. That's rather than 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and it floats.
Yeah. And you can feel that flow when you do it like that. Yeah. It's got some similarities to the simultaneous learning kind of approach of Paul Harris too in the UK. Are you familiar with his
there was a thinking? I can't remember now, but I remember reading some of his writings.
Yeah, and his approach is very much look for the ingredients, like patterns, and mm-hmm. before a student ever looks at the music, let's feel that pattern. Let's drum it. Let's tap it. Let's chant it. Let's do everything so that by the time the student gets to actually look at the music, it's like, I've already written that pattern out. I've already chanted it. I know how that pattern goes. I don't have to think about it. And I think there's some similarities there too.
Yeah. The difference is that Gordon has a music pattern vocabulary. It took me a long time to get this. I thought I can do my own patterns. But that's not true. You have a specific series of patterns. We have it with music moves. The band method has their own patterns. It doesn't matter. They're sequenced, though, and categorized. So students learn these patterns by we teach them the patterns.
Mm.
And then they use the patterns. And then they can recognize the patterns. So there's a very, very strong component of teaching.
So right from the beginning, they're building up a vocabulary of common patterns.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Got it. Yep. And what they look like, how they feel, how they sound. That would be right.
Well, again, look.
Do they learn to look at, like, see what they look like in notation at the beginning? Or is it really just oral?
No. Some children do. They're just all different. Some are just attuned to that page, and you can say, look, this is what you just chanted. This is what it looks like. Others could care less. And I never ask them to look until they reach a certain point when their brain can process abstract thinking. And they can learn that you could write that pattern two different ways and it would sound the same. That in rhythmic notation is very important. It's just like in tonality where we write tonic patterns and dominant patterns in different keys.
Got it. Yeah, makes sense. Cool. All right. Well, this has been great to explore. We're running out of time, so I'm going to start wrapping up in just a moment. But I'm quite interested. You said you're going to give a two-week workshop in Boston coming up. It sounds like a very long amount of time, which is great for teachers. What kind of things do you cover there? Do you take them right through from the beginning of your method, right through with students? This is how you teach it?
Actually, it's sponsored by the Gordon Institute. So it's split into two halves. The morning half is all about his theories, and we use his book, Learning Sequences in Music. Do you have his book?
No, I haven't. I've seen it, but I haven't got a copy.
It's really wonderful, and the study guide is amazing, and I continue to read in it and learn from it. It's just one of those, kind of like a dictionary.
But I think I did read somewhere that it's quite heavy going.
Oh my gosh! I every time I read it, I want to summarize it with a few sentences and leave out a lot because I don't know what to say. It's very complete. He was very thorough. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
So anyway, the study guide helps. It has questions and answers, and it's a big help. But where was I going with this?
The overview of your day. You said the morning.
The mornings are spent with the books and studying his theories. The afternoon is spent in the practical. So I have outlined it, and I'm honestly thinking I could spend two weeks, every day with the practical, how to do this, because there's so much students can do. And it is pretty fascinating to see how students learn from each other, but if that fundamental background of movement and patterns and singing and chanting is not there, it's teaching way above what they really should be having for a foundation. It's amazing. One of my students who was very good, won some competitions but would not sing for me, put a blurb on Facebook with him playing and singing. And it was very, very nice. So I had to comment, is this the piano student that would not sing in piano class? And he and his parents all responded. So if the input is right, it's going in, regardless of the response of the student. That's what is amazing me. It will come out later. I've had older students say, that's what you mean. I heard it. Mm. Something they did earlier. So it's just this internalization.
Yeah. That's great.
And being patient with it and taking time and not rushing into saying they've got to read these and name these notes and count these counts. Because how in the world can you count rhythm when half notes have different functions and different meters and different tempos?
Yeah. No, it's good to make us all think about that. Think about just how hard it actually is. And I've interviewed Neil Moore of Simply Music, and he was talking about the fact that when we get students to read, it's like learning multiple languages at the same time because they're trying to decipher rhythm, pitch, dynamics, finger numbers, metric counting. I don't know how anyone does it. It's amazingly complex.
So I have an outline for students to follow. I said, this is a template you put in your head. First you decide the meter. Then you decide what note you're going to call a macrobeat. Then you look over the rhythm patterns and compare them. And then you improvise on the rhythm patterns.
Yeah.
Then you start looking at tonality. And what has really surprised me about this approach is I have not done a lot of sight reading. I've always been a good sight reader, but haven't done it for like 20 years. And a vocal student wanted me to play for him. And I said, I'll give it a try. Well, how songs are in these double, seven sharps, six sharps, et cetera. But I noticed that my brain was scanning. This is the meter. These are the rhythm patterns. This is the tonality. These are the tonal patterns. This is the harmonic movement. It just, in a split second, scanned all of that. I was aware that it was scanning it. And then I played it fine, first time. So that's what I'm trying to train my students to do when they look at new music. Not just put it up and start playing.
Yep, yep. And that's what we all want of our students. I think that's a really good kind of way to finish up almost there, Marilyn. You've mentioned the Gordon Institute of Music Learning. So giml.org is one place people can go. Where can they go to find out more about you and your method?
Well, www.musicmovesforpiano.com is the website that has information on it. There are also podcasts of all the CDs, except the pattern CD, that can be downloaded free.
Right. Where do they download that? Is that from your website?
On the website, yep. Right.
And where are the podcasts? Are they on your website as well?
Yeah, the podcasts are on the website.
Great.
For download. They're
great.
Just right there, right page. And they can contact me at Marilyn@musicmovesforpiano.com.
Fantastic.
Glad to hear from you.
Hey, oh, that's great. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, Marilyn. I know that your brain is everywhere at the moment because you said you're about to travel and you've got these workshops coming up. So I really appreciate you squeezing in a chance to chat. And I know lots of teachers are going to get lots out of it. And just learning a little bit more about another method is just so important, I think, even if it does nothing else but make us rethink our approach to reading and teaching, listening, and that sort of thing. So thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And I wish you all the best too for your forthcoming travels and workshops and things like that. Hopefully we'll get to meet face-to-face at some stage soon.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, Marilyn. Thank you again for your time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Bye-bye.
If the idea of a piano teacher's community where you get to access the best educational resources, rub shoulders with expert teachers from around the world, and have immediate access to feedback for any of your questions, then Inner Circle membership is for you. The Inner Circle is my private community of piano teachers from across the globe who share a commitment to creating and delivering the most inspiring, modern, and progressive learning experiences for their students. Membership is now open, so head to timtopham.com/community to find out more and get involved today. I can't wait to see you on the inside.